Salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Friday, August 24th of the year 2018. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who's so glad to be back with you here right at the tail end of August. My oh my, where has that summer gone? Good God, it's basically over. But we're not here to depress you. While we still have time together, we're going to make it count. We're going to try and infotain you to the best of our abilities.
Indeed, and I'm the other voice on this program, as I am always. This week I'm Dennis, the man who once again encourages anyone in the Winnipeg area to come watch his band Dissolution open for Power Glove at the Pyramid Cabaret this Sunday, August 26th, 2018.
In this the year of our Lord.
Anno Domine. Yes.
It's been a while since there's been a shameless plug for one of your band's shows.
Yeah, you know, it's been a while. We don't really play that much these days, but we got a show coming up, and it's opening for Power Glove. So if you're in Winnipeg, hey, it's August 26, 2018.
Do it. It's a Sunday night, so what else are you really doing? I mean, you can always just make your sandwiches for work in the morning. That's okay.
Or, you know, go to Quiznos on the way there or whatever.
Yeah,
like, or, you know, whatever you're gonna do.
Go for a walk on your lunch break anyway, and if you like, just get a small soup or salad somewhere, that's fine.
Yeah.
It's one day out of the week, that's fine.
Yeah. Don't, I mean, unless you had a whole prep thing planned, that's fine. Do it earlier. Just,
it's true.
We're on a little bit later. Unless, of course, you're like, no, I work really early Monday, and that's also fair. I can respect that.
We understand. Early mornings suck, and we're there with you. But if you have the opportunity, come see Dissolution, and come see Power Glove.
Yes.
Is this their first time in Winnipeg?
I think it's their second time in Winnipeg that I can recall.
Okay.
First time headlining in Winnipeg. I want to say that they were opening for Korplakani or some other bigger power metal band a few years ago. And maybe they came through here with Dragon Force at some point as well. Either way, this is the first headlining show that I can recall, and they are a treat. They're worth it. They're worth watching live.
If you're not familiar with Power Glove, what can people expect to hear?
Well, we've played them several times on this program for Halloween music specials and whatnot. And
just other times when he phoned it in on episodes.
Yeah. I don't think there's any of those on the archives available, but it's fine. They are fast, you know, kind of more aggressive heavy metal, but they're all arrangements of video game music, and they have one album of Saturday morning cartoon themes that they've done arrangements of. And on that one, actually, there's an awesome, I don't think it'll happen live, like they may play the song musically live, but on that one album they did the Pokemon theme song, and they got the singer of Sonata Arctica to sing it, and it was pretty awesome.
This is true. Unless the singer of Sonata Arctica is in town, which I don't think.
No, I don't think he just randomly will be in Winnipeg for no reason, as he is a Finnish person, and I don't think Sonata Arctica is touring right now, so he probably has family and stuff that he would probably rather be with, I would imagine.
Understandable, too.
Yeah.
And really, the big draw here is Power Glove for their body of work, not the one singular song they did of the Pokemon theme, or the Pokemon rap, excuse me.
Exactly. But
I believe they describe their style as what, video game metal?
Yeah, I think that's a safe thing to call them.
And if that sounds like something that tickles your fancy, come down to the Pyramid Cabaret Sunday night, August 26th. Doors open at 7:30. Tickets available at the door. It's worth your time.
Absolutely.
Has that been sufficiently plugged?
Excellent.
Anything else we wish to plug while we're going on this? I have nothing.
No, I've got nothing else.
All right, well, if there's another show coming up, certainly that Dissolution is playing, we will let you know about it here on this program, because one quarter of Dissolution is on this podcast.
Yes, and one of us has, half of the podcast is in Dissolution, so there you go. Oh, the numbers keep getting bigger.
Those are some fine percentages.
Yes.
But certainly, I mean, it's been a while since Dissolution played, so go see Dissolution, and also, I mean, I'm sure they're in, you know, live performing shape at this point, right?
Yeah, right? I hope so. I mean, I am. I don't know about the rest of the guys.
That's the kind of band camaraderie I've come to expect.
Well, when you've been in a band for a number of years, I'm not going to say how many because it's starting to get ridiculous. A lot. You just kind of have no problem throwing everyone else under the bus.
All right, well, there's a level of comfort that gets developed within a band dynamic after a certain point.
Yes.
Understandable. since we're through plugging things for this week and for the weekend, we will instead turn our attention now to the ludicrous lead-off, the new story we have for you. That's just a little bit of extra special, kind of special. I guess you could say this one is a bit of science goes crazy, or just a gross misuse of technology as it currently exists. And we've spoken a number of times on the program this year and in years past of the advances made in artificial intelligence and how it will eventually lead to the robot apocalypse and machines throwing or overthrowing humanity, leading to our ultimate downfall and enslavement at the hands of the machines.
Yeah, though I don't know if I should mention this before we mention what this is, but I'm going to. I feel one of the things I've noticed with the trend of AI is that there's no middle ground in terms of, you know, how benign the use is for AI. It's either super benign and silly and kind of really scary and crazy.
This is true. I don't know how there's those extremes yet, how there's been no balance to things yet.
Yeah, I mean, okay, maybe you could consider, you know, the things where you have to, like, select all the stop signs and, you know, to prove you're a human or whatever, as maybe being somewhere in between. But I would also say that that's kind of just benign as well. But because you have all those things. Well, first of all, we'll say what this latest advance is. I guess it's more of like a tech demo for Google's new service called Google's Auto ML, which I believe this is the vision version of Auto ML, which is a software as a service that Google is rolling out, which is their it's basically a platform for machine learning, which is what most of AI is based on. Basically, the way you train an AI model is you basically feed it tons and tons of data. You know, in some of the more scarier cases we've seen, it's been like feed them tons and tons of pictures of one specific person's face, and then they'll be able to depending on the model that you're using, it'll be able to kind of replace any other face in a video or picture or whatever with that face, oftentimes being used to make those things called deep fakes, which are often, unfortunately, fake porn, which opens up a whole can of worms and whatever. That, as well as, like, you know, other models, like being able to synthesize people's voices for, I believe it was called Warbler, I think is the...
There was Warbler, and I recall there being something called Lyrebird.
Yeah, Lyrebird as well. So, kind of bird-themed things, but this one, so that's the one end of things where it's like, it could be used for all these devastating effects.
Sinister purposes.
I mean, obviously some okay purposes as well. Like we saw someone made basically a way better version of Princess Leia, you know, after Carrie Fisher died, they just kind of like played around with the model and they made a way better looking one than they did for millions of dollars with, you know, real artists and stuff putting it together, as well as someone showing that it could have been way easier to get rid of the mustache on
Henry Cavill.
Henry Cavill, yes.
In Justice League.
Yeah, in Justice League. Doing a better job than the artist in there as well.
Who were paid millions of dollars.
Yeah, again, millions of dollars, as opposed to like 15, 20 minutes on a basic desktop computer that anyone has. But yeah, that's the more extreme, off to the side, usually more sinister kind of things. Then there's the super benign, like this.
And this advancement is, like we said, basically a tech demo for the Google Cloud Auto ML service. And it was put together by a creative company called Red Pepper. And they developed something called There's Waldo. And what it is, it's a camera-based AI system where it is able to scan the pages of a Where's Waldo book and pick out where Waldo is.
Yeah.
It's been fed data, a data set, so it can determine what Waldo looks like. It was fed a bunch of images of what Waldo looks like in different poses, different close-ups, different croppings, if you will, because Waldo isn't always appearing full body. He's often placed behind something as well. And I think according to Matt Reed, who's the creative technologist at Red Pepper, he was talking to The Verge about this, to Dami Lee of The Verge about this, and said, I got all of the Waldo training images from Google Image Search. 62 distinct Waldo heads and 45 Waldo heads plus body. I thought that wouldn't be enough data to build a strong model, but it gives surprisingly good predictions on Waldos that weren't in the original training set. And this thing is able to just pick out and find Waldos with a 95% confidence rating or higher.
Yep.
And it points it out, and how it does that, it has just a floppy silicone prosthetic hand that it just kind of smashes down on the page to where Waldo is.
Yeah, so it's a metal robotic arm called the UArm Swift Pro, which is controlled by a Raspberry Pi, which is then in turn equipped with a vision camera kit that does the facial recognition. So someone flips the page underneath this camera. The camera takes a second to scan the whole gatefold page. It's using a technology called OpenCV, which is basically this technology that lets you easily identify faces in any sort of, you know, picture. And it does a really good job depending on how big the data model is. And then it basically goes through all the faces and determines, like, it scans, it builds up a confidence rating mm-hmm. based on all of its training set versus all the other pictures that it finds in the, you know, in the group. And it basically loops through, sometimes in the cases of Where's Waldo pages, there's like hundreds of characters.
Oh God, yeah.
Like, I want to say that it's not uncommon for there to be like an upwards of like 500 little tinily drawn people.
In some of those books, especially I'm thinking of the Where's Waldo in Hollywood one, like yeah. Some of the last pages is just crazy. When you have all the extras in the pages, it's insane.
Yeah, so there's hundreds of them. And it basically, within the span of like a second, because it's a super fast computer program, it can just loop through all 100 and go, what's the confidence rating here? Then just sort by the highest confidence rating and go, oh, it's that one. Then it just basically picks out the XY coordinates and then comically flops this, you know, doll hand down and goes, there it is. It doesn't say there it is, but you could
if
picture.
If it could talk,
you'd be a kind of dumb, like, there it is.
Found it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it'll point out anytime it gets to 95% confidence or higher. Forgive me, I misspoke earlier about the 95% confidence rating. I'm going to hell. But nevertheless, and it's able to do this pretty damn fast. According to the description that Red Pepper wrote on this YouTube video, it says, while only a prototype, the fastest There's Waldo has pointed out a match has been 4.45 seconds, which is better than most 5-year-olds, end quote.
Well, I remember when I was, however young I was when I got, you know, when we were all into Waldo books. I mean, we all have one or two of them ourselves, I'm sure, at mm-hmm. somewhere in our house.
Or taking them out from the library at school.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, just read them at school during, you know, library class or whatever it was. And then just, I definitely remember spending minutes on some of those pages because there's a lot to take in on a Waldo page. Like,
and certainly, and it all depends what you're looking for too. If you just are on a singular mission to find Waldo, that's one thing that can take minutes. But do you find the wizard? Do you find Wendy? Do you find the dog? Do you find Waldo's inverse nemesis?
Yeah, Oddlaw or whatever.
Oddlaw,
his name is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Waldo backwards. Are you looking for the bone? Are you looking for the scroll, the cane, like everything else that goes along with it?
Or are you just appreciating the ridiculous art? Because the art's always ridiculous. There's a lot going on.
It sure is. I think it was earlier this spring, actually. I was sitting with my nephew at one point. He had taken some Waldo books out from his school library. He's all of 6 years old at the point, or at that point in time, and trying to go through them, and I, as the older person, trying to be like, okay, youngin, let's sit down and find Waldo, and open the page, and within, like, a minute, he's found Waldo.
Yeah.
And was like, shit.
Well, never mind.
All right.
I guess you are far more observant than I ever was.
Let's move along, then.
It's like, oh yeah, well, how about this page where it's all Waldos? Find the real one.
Oh god, I hated that. That was a nightmare.
Yeah, it's like, it's the one without the shoe. Oh, I see, because you can see his shoe over there. Ooh, interesting. I think that's the book I have somewhere. I'll have to dig it up one of these days. But yeah, 4 seconds is insane.
For an AI system, so...
And it's still, like, he says, very much a proof of concept, like a prototype. So I'm sure if he trained it up even better, and maybe... made, like, I don't know if that robe, the arm or whatever he used is maybe the most efficient. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe if they used a better computer than a Raspberry Pi.
More, a bigger data set, more images.
Yeah.
So it would have just more information to, compare against and could get to a conclusion quicker, or reach a higher confidence quicker because it just has more input.
Yeah, exactly.
Something like that. So, the human experience of finding Waldo, in those goddamn books, that's on its way out. So that's always fun. But at least we can still appreciate the art of them because machines can't do that.
Yeah. And exactly.
Maybe as an adult, maybe that's really what we should be doing is just appreciating the art that they're all hand drawn.
Like, yeah, pages. Exactly.
Everything you see in those goddamn Waldo books, I keep cursing them because I'd never liked them as a kid. I could barely find Waldo.
I used to love them. I found Waldo in every page.
I could find the wizard a bit easier because he had the hat, but...
Yeah, I think I was able to go through and find almost everything back in the day. I love those books. I don't know why.
Fair enough.
Just everyone has their different things. I love those books.
But to look at them now, like...
There's a lot of stuff going on in all the pages. It's impressive artwork.
You have it has to be a planned out image. You can't just kind of start freehanding and see where you end up.
No, but yeah, so no in between with AI.
No.
There's no in between. It's either, oh, we're going to train this to do stupid things like, you know, find point out Waldo or like, whatever. Mm-hmm. Or we're going to impersonate the president and fake a bunch of video and audio where it makes it sound like he said something way worse than the things he already says. Or other people. Make it look like someone is in a bunch of porn when they weren't.
Exactly.
Like, no in between.
So that's always fun. Yep, AI. What will humans do with it next?
I'm curious, but I also don't want to know.
I wonder if this approach, this system of finding Waldo, will ultimately be appropriated and then turned into a means of, for military purposes or whatever sinister purposes of just picking out faces in a crowd and find that one target in a crowd.
Oh, that's already been done.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, 100% that's already been done.
All right.
And the military probably has way better training models than we do for, you know... training an AI model, it takes a long time the more pictures you have to feed into a visual model like that anyways. Mm-hmm. And the military has supercomputers and stuff to do so with, so they have the technology that we do not have yet.
Fair point. So let's not think about that.
Yes.
At all. That's disturbing.
This is a whole other discussion for a whole other podcast that we don't really...
We're probably not qualified
to get into it. No, we're not qualified to get into it because, and also, I don't want to think about that. That's not a thing I want to think about. What I want to think about is video games for now.
That's right. And there was a number of release dates for Nintendo games and for the Switch that came out last week. It was a big day of, or a big week of Nintendo Switch announcements. And this week was kind of a big week for just non-specific, just more general release dates for titles. We'll start with a bit of a disappointing one. It's a title that I'm sure a lot of people, myself and yourself included, have been looking forward to. It's been in development for several years and is starting to make me wonder if it's going to be or if it's now becoming a crowdfunding cautionary tale.
Yeah. Because there are so many of those. You know, the super funded Kickstarter put out by someone who on the surface seems like they should know what they're doing and should know how to deliver on something like this. I keep thinking about Tim Schafer, who was to us for quite a long time, Tim Screw Budget Schafer, because, you know,
the Double Fine Kickstarter, Double Fine Adventure Kickstarter was super funded and he basically exploded the scope of the game and needed another round of funding.
Yeah, where he initially was asking for what, like $300,000 or something, and then ended up getting $3 million, and then all of a sudden went super out of budget, and then the game's budget ballooned to like $6 million or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Koji Igarashi, you know, the person who was responsible for the Bloodstained Kickstarter, and also more notably, historically speaking as well, being the director of Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
Yes, a game that actually has released.
Yeah, a classic game at this point, one that's basically a genre-defining game where it combined with Super Metroid, invented the genre of Metroidvania, which is a thing. If you think we're lying, look up the term Metroidvania. Mm-hmm. You'll be pleasantly surprised.
They're not full of shit.
No, we guys know it. Those guys sometimes know what they're talking about. Sometimes. But, yeah, so his Kickstarter for Bloodstained Ritual of the Night, which is the spiritual successor, which is a term I hate using, but it really makes sense in this case, where it's the person who is responsible for all of the soul and everything of Castlevania Symphony of the Night, basically giving him another kick at the can of it, you know, whereas he clearly doesn't have the rights to do a Castlevania game, he's going to do a Castlevania-esque game.
Exactly, and he's working outside Konami at this point too, so he has no access to the intellectual property, the series, the franchise, but he is commonly associated with that franchise, so he'll do as close to as he can without getting sued.
Yeah, without being Icarus and flying too close to the sun and burning his wings.
Exactly. And we saw this too with Mighty Number 9 as well.
Yeah, exactly.
With that being basically a Mega Man game without being a Mega Man game and being a flawed game in general as well.
Yeah, when it came out it was maybe a little bit disappointing. But we're not talking about that right now. What we are talking about is how Bloodstained Ritual of the Night was, you know, supposed to launch sometime in 2018, from what I recall.
I think it's suffered a number of delays.
Right, yeah. So the Kickstarter was funded in 2015, never had a set launch date, but its release window shifted a couple of times. So it was first supposed to arrive in March of 2017, but then backers, were informed of a delay back in 2016, and then the launch was postponed to early 2018. Well, early 2018 is no longer, it's come and gone. There's no way that you can say any bit of the remaining bit of 2018 is early 2018 anymore at this point. So
we're in the hell? Late stage 2018.
Yes, we are in end game 2018. So where is it? Well, now we've been informed that it'll launch sometime in 2019. And also we've lost a potential version.
That's true. Along with the announcement of the delay that it's now being pushed back to a whole new calendar year, Koji Igarashi in the video and also written update to the Kickstarter campaign page, noted that the PlayStation Vita version has now been cancelled. And this isn't uncommon for this campaign because the Wii U version of the game was also cancelled, though at the time, it made sense because the Wii U was no longer going to be a supported platform and everyone was migrating over to the Switch.
Yeah.
And obviously, the Switch is now where a lot of people are, and that's A-okay. That makes total sense. But there's still a small but dedicated fan base for the PlayStation Vita. However, they now are SOL because the Vita version has been canceled. If you are one of those people who bought into this. We're expecting the game on the Vita. What you can do is request a refund or stipulate which other system, which other platform you'd like to receive the game on. Now, the interesting thing in this announcement of the Vita version being canceled is not necessarily that it was Koji Igarashi's decision to cancel the Vita version, but canceling it because Sony is planning to discontinue the Vita console and just end production of it entirely and end production of physical copies and no longer support the online store. So just the Vita, whatever small pulse it may have still had in this gaming realm, will be snuffed out.
Yeah, but at least, I mean, it makes sense. Why put a bunch of effort into something that's not a thing anymore? Of course, we're not going to speak to any of those newer Genesis or Super Nintendo games that are still coming out. But in 20 years, maybe we'll see new Vita games again. But
true too.
But at any rate, so sometime in 2019.
And also they threw in the standard line of like, well, this is too, as they say here.
Spit polish, yeah.
Yeah. Spin polish, the specific term being to raise the quality level, especially after they released a beta backer demo and got some very strong opinions on it.
Yeah.
Which I guess this is good as opposed to just releasing a broken and unfinished game or just a very not refined game. So
yeah.
By the time it comes out, it'll be 4 years at least since the campaign was completed. That's a long time.
Yeah, that is a long time. And, yeah.
So at least when it comes out, it'll be on all the current platforms, Xbox One, PlayStation 4, PC, and Switch as well. So at least there's that to look forward to. And when this comes out, you can get it on either PlayStation 4 or Switch as well. You'll have your bounty of options.
I will indeed.
So disappointing news in that regard, and it would not surprise me again if I see this game delayed one more time.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even doubt if it's a 2020 release at this point.
And then just kind of delayed for the new generation of consoles.
Yeah. Just as consoles become unsupported. Maybe that's his ultimate goal. He just wants to see all the consoles not supported so we can just release it on PC. They're like, well, let's go release it on Steam. And everyone's going to go, what? Okay, guess whatever. I'm not playing this game.
And then just keep the rest of the money that would have been required to release it on PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and Switch. Just, I bought a Ferrari.
Yeah, exactly. But speaking of big games that, you know, seemed like they were never going to come out.
And were crowdfunded,
at least in part. Shenmue 3 was sort of one of those big things to talk about a couple of years ago when it was crowdfunded through Kickstarter for a suspiciously low amount given the scope of what the game is or given the scope of what the game franchise has led us to believe that a Shenmue game is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then after it was funded, we later saw Sony get kind of involved in a kind of mysterious capacity of like maybe they're providing more money,
though it was never detailed to any extent to what their level of involvement was. If there was actually a financial transaction, not impossible. I believe this is set to come to PC and PlayStation 4, this new Shenmue 3 game, but I guess we'll have more details closer to its release, because now it's been stated by Yu Suzuki and the rest of his team at EASE that Shenmue 3 now has a release date, and it's not anytime soon. It is a literal year away. The actual release date that they have stated in a new trailer, which we link to on our website, thearcadeshow.com, is August 27th of 2019.
Yes.
That's a calendar year away. Basically 365 days.
Well, on the one hand, yeah, that sucks. But on the other hand, at least they're just not even trying to get anyone's hopes up, and knowing full well that it's going to be a delayed thing if they do. So good. But also, what happens when it too gets delayed? Because Shenmue games are huge.
They sure are.
Like, they're huge, sprawling adventures that have, like, a huge cast of characters, a gigantic world, and
a lot of scripting and scenes that need to be written out, planning of things, worlds that need to be developed. And especially in these modern gaming times where it has to look good.
Yeah, like, if you're going to be doing a game like that, you have to be kind of at par with things like The Witcher and
Grand Theft Auto 5
and like, and the, well, I mean, maybe not Naughty Dog, maybe not Rockstar, because those are the highest of the high AAA super studios. So, I mean, I think hopefully people have a little bit of tempered expectations for a kickstarted game, but even still, like,
can you really temper your expectations though for a crowdfunded game when it's
a game Shenmue 3
has a history of huge scope and worlds?
Yeah, especially when Yu Suzuki was basically initially saying that there was going to be 11 chapters in this game where it might even be too big to be one game. Again, Tim Screwbudget Schaefer. Itis. I'm just going to say it's a disease now. It's a condition.
I like how it's evolved.
It's Tim Screwbudget Schaefer's disease. TSBD.
But, I like how it's mutated.
Yes.
There's no known cure.
There's no known cure. It's a terminal condition.
But, causes your game to be delayed and for you to run out of funding.
Yes. And spend twice your budget.
I wonder if that's happened in this case, because when it was sold, when it was initially pitched, I should say, Shenmue 3, the Kickstarter campaign, was to be like a proof of concept, show that there's still an audience for this kind of game, and ultimately it was crowdfunded to the tune of several million dollars, and presumably then Sony came in with a large check as well, likely for several million dollars, so... I mean, you can't really do a Shenmue game on the cheap. When they initially came out on the Dreamcast back in the day, they were some of the most expensive games ever.
Yeah. Like.
And were tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah. Tens of millions. I want to say maybe like $30 million, even for like a game back in 1998, which was unheard of back then.
Oh yeah. That's like the water world of a video game.
Yeah. But, you know, they still did well back then. But yeah, the other interesting thing, it really does sound like this will not actually be the final chapter in the Shenmue saga, because as I mentioned, that whole 11 chapters thing, Suzuki said, you know, originally, as you know, this is a quote, there was going to be 11 chapters. It was only ever going to be two games. When we began development, the volume of the story was too big for one game. When we decided it was going to be two games, most of the story was already complete. To fit all of the rest of the 11 chapters into Shenmue 3, it could help the story progress, but it'd lose its playability. Shenmue's a game, not a novel. If it loses its playability, it loses its purpose, so it's not the final part. Period. So no word of any sort of Shenmue 4 Kickstarter yet, but of course, let's not get ahead of ourselves. We still have a year for Shenmue 3 before it comes out, so...
In some ways, I can respect the fact that they're announcing a release date this far off.
Yeah.
It's out there. It can kind of quell any sort of questions people have of when's it coming out. Here, it placates and pacifies the audience who want to know, the backers who want to know. They've stuck their flag on a release date in the future. Cool, now that it's out there, they can just kind of close ranks, circle the herd, and just kind of hunker down and keep working instead of being hounded by questions or having to worry about people asking them and needing to satisfy the curious people who are demanding to know more about this game. Here, it has a release date. Leave us alone.
Yeah.
Very much seems like the approach. And people will forget about it. People will totally forget that there's a release date pegged for this thing. So even if it's delayed, who's going to remember? Like, oh, it's pushed back to, like, October 2019.
It's like, oh, yeah, that was supposed to come out this year. Oh.
So, say, like, even if we get to December of this year or January, February of next year, and it's delayed again by a couple months, who's going to care? Because it was so far off already.
Yeah.
What does 2 months make when you're already 5 months away?
Yeah, exactly. So that's, it might be a genius strategy. We'll see. We'll see what the game looks like when it comes out.
That's true. We'll see what happens. And likely when it comes out, there will be like a full HD remaster remake of the previous games, I'm sure. Because that's the thing that happens with old successful games. Companies find a way to re-release them.
That's true. And one company that is doing just that is From Software, who have done a lot of games in the past, but most recently in the last 5-10 years or so, or 5 to 8, not 10 years, but, you know, 7-ish years or so, they've been kind of known as the Dark Souls people. Dark Souls, Bloodborne. That's sort of been like the thing where they've kind of helped bring really hard gaming back. They basically looked at all the games on the NES and went, you know what? Let's do that again. But also, you know, make them enjoyable games that people will actually want to play. And yeah, so without getting into the philosophy behind, you know, playing Dark Souls and feeling, you know, really accomplished with yourself or whatever, yeah, so the first Dark Souls is kind of looks a little bit old at this point, which is why they came out with, you know, the remastered version,
which initially released back in May of this year on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One.
And it looks great.
It does. And we spoke last week of the fact that Dark Souls Remastered now has a release date for the Nintendo Switch version that is set for October 19th. Cool. So the Switch people can finally get Dark Souls on their system. That's the same day the Dark Souls amiibo comes out as well. So great. A great day for Dark Souls Remastered on Switch and people who want to take Dark Souls on the go. Cool. Well, in kind of a kick in the teeth to the Switch people, if you will, sure, they got their release date, but the bigger, older, major console counterparts, the Xbox One and PlayStation 4, on that same day Remastered comes out to the Switch, those two platforms, PlayStation 4 and Xbox One, will be getting the Dark Souls Trilogy Collection, which already has Dark Souls Remastered in it.
Yes.
Plus Dark Souls 2 and also Dark Souls 3. So the more definitive editions of Dark Souls 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Because Dark Souls 2 will be Scholar of the First Sin, and also Dark Souls 3, the Fire Fades edition. So there, the more complete versions of both of those games.
Yeah, with, yeah, the reversion slash, you know, all the DLC in it.
Yes. And those will be offered for around $80 US for a physical release, which seems like the standard going rate hell for a Switch game even, or just a modern game in these days. God, gaming's expensive now.
It is, but it's still cheaper than it was in the Super Nintendo days.
True. There's no $100 games.
No, and also, even, I mean, I distinctly remember buying Donkey Kong Country on Super Nintendo for $80 back in 1995. So $80 in 1995, that's like $150 now, so we're doing okay. We're still doing okay.
True enough. So the physical release, yeah, it's a shiny steelbook case for $80 US, all on October 19th. So Switch people, enjoy your remastered version of the first game. Most other people are getting the full game set if they're looking at getting into the Dark Souls games at all. This is the collection.
Yeah. I already bought the remastered for PS4, so
this does nothing for you.
No. I mean, it'd be nice to get...
You had 2 and 3 already, didn't you?
I had 2 on PlayStation 3, and I never had 3, though I'm told 3 is maybe the best of the Dark Souls series. One of my friends who's a super Dark Souls aficionado, I think he says that Dark Souls 3 is his favorite, then Bloodborne is his second favorite, then Dark Souls 1, then maybe Demon Souls, then Dark Souls 2. Which is, like, fine. I mean, Bloodborne's cool. Really like Bloodborne. never played Dark Souls 3, which maybe whenever this comes out, or when this comes out, I'll maybe have to remedy that. Hopefully they'll offer some sort of discount if I've already purchased the Dark Souls, you know, 1 remastered edition. But we'll see.
So again, October 19th is just Dark Souls Day. Let's yes. just generalize that. October 19th of this fall is Dark Souls Day. So no doubt, From Software, Bandai Namco, everyone involved with Dark Souls Day will be making a lot of money, but I don't know if it'll be quite as much money as we're going to talk about right now, because this past week and ongoing has been the Dota 2 tournament, the annual esports tournament that brings together the big Dota 2 tournament called the International. This year is the 8th iteration of it that brings together all the best Dota 2 teams to basically play and see who's the best in the world. And the real appeal of this to non-Dota 2 people is just the amount of money that is in the prize pool for this thing. So it's a crazy amount of money that's just been getting crazier with each annual iteration of this event. I started off with a couple million. Last year was, I think the total prize pool was like $24.7 million. And this year's prize pool has surpassed that and is now the insane sum of $25,194,791.
So far.
So far.
As of recording.
Yes. Here on Thursday, August 23rd. So, good God, that is more than some lottery jackpots.
Yep. I mean, no, granted, that doesn't go just to one person.
No, it does not.
So whoever wins, like, I mean, it will be split up amongst, like, you know, various tiers. Like, last year of the $24,787,000 that was raised, the first place, you know, like, the distribution was the first place got, you know, $10,800,000-ish, almost $900,000. You know, second place was $3.9 million, third place $2.5 million, fourth place $1.7 million. And down until, you know, 18th place is $61,000. Still, I wouldn't mind 18th place. What I could do is $61,000. Boy, I'll tell you the things I'd do.
Go on. Not right now.
No.
Fair enough.
This is an off the air affair, but,
Oh my.
But yeah, so.
So over 25 million is the current prize pool. Again, that will be distributed to the top however many winning teams at the International 8. And the crazy thing is, this is community-generated prize pool.
Yeah, so that's the thing. It kind of rubbed us, I think, a little bit the wrong way last year when we were reading about it, talking about it. Because, you know, unlike some of these other prize pools that are put up by other companies who actually seem to, like, believe in their product and, you know, want to give back to the community, this is Valve, and Valve's whole MO is to just make money and basically not do a lot to, you know, work for it anymore, it seems.
The less they do, the more profit they can make.
Yeah, which is why we haven't really seen any Valve games in the last quite some time.
8 years?
8 years-ish since Portal 2.
Don't even ask about Half-Life 3.
No, because that's never going to happen. They've been kind of pretty unequivocally clear about that. But yeah, so, you know, unlike the Fortnite tournament that happened recently, which the money was put up by Epic Games.
It was, and even before the summer tournaments began, Epic Games announced that they're going to do a whole season of competitive tournaments. And Epic Games is funding everything.
Yeah, so all the whole track of money that goes out, it's coming from Epic Games. It's a way of giving back to the community to say, hey, thanks for playing our game. Thanks for making us all this money.
Thanks for making us the biggest game in the world.
Yeah, so we clearly don't need all of this money. So, you know, plus us doing this will make our game even more popular. So
it's true.
Yeah, but Valve, all of this prize pool is 100% just done through people purchasing tickets through this website.
They can, or purchasing things called battle passes.
Yeah.
Which are $10 a pop, though there are tiers that can go as high as $37 a pop. And from those battle passes, from those largely $10 battle passes, 25% of the money goes into the prize pool for the international tournament.
Yeah, and the other 75% goes into the pockets of Valve. So, to let that sink in for a second, even though there is a $25.1 million prize pool so far, all that means is that Valve has made $75 million doing nothing. Literally nothing. They put up a website and went, hey, want to spend a bunch of money here?
And people went, yes.
Yeah.
In resounding numbers.
Yeah.
It's got to be some sort of running joke inside the Valve offices that they can just get money for literally nothing. They have to be listening to the Dire Straits all day long, every day.
Yeah.
Because it is money for nothing.
Yeah, I mean, it really is.
Like, how much money does it go into producing whatever battle passes for the annual tournament that they sell?
Not $75 million. I mean, I'm just going to straight up say that right now. So, yeah, I mean, at least they're making no bones about it. At least they're, I mean, they're not straight up saying, ha ha, we're just making a bunch of money off you suckers, but they're not trying to make, you know, some Robert Space Industries kind of BS about, you know, we have a game, coming out that, you might want to keep, giving us some, money for,
Why do your eyes keep darting around?
You don't sound sure of what you're saying either. Don't worry about it.
Why are you sweating profusely?
Wait, where are you going? Why is there a plane right there?
Money was falling out of your pockets. Come back.
Come back, Robert Space Industries. I want to buy a $7,500 3D model that I can look at on my computer. Maybe. But yeah, Valve is just basically saying, yeah, we'll take your money. And
that's it.
And that's it. We're not even going to make a game or anything. We're just going to put this website up where you can give us money. And, yeah, we'll host a tournament with all of this money that you've given us. But, the majority of this money we'll keep. And, you know, we'll just put it into the Valve fund for us to keep.
I mean, apparently, according to a report from Alyssa McAloon from GamSutra.com, she says that Valve starts off the prize pool at a base amount of $1.6 million, and that's what they did this year, and then the rest of the money is generated through the sales of the Battle Pass. So, okay.
Okay, so if no one bought anything, they would have had to give up $1.6 million. But then they sold $100 million worth of passes, so they don't have to give up anything. Nothing is given up. They've still netted like $74 million. Like,
they made 75 times their starting amount.
Yeah.
That's a good return on investment.
Oh man.
I don't understand how this dynamic works. I mean, obviously it's working well, and it's why Gabe Newell is a goddamn billionaire.
Yeah, richer than Donald Trump, according to the Forbes Top 100. But,
take that for what it's worth.
Yeah, whatever that's worth. But, he might be much richer than Donald Trump. Who knows? But, yeah, Valve,
It seems like Valve is just given, like, I don't want to say a pass, but there doesn't seem to be much critical attention that I see or am privy to or aware of being paid to the fact that they're just shamelessly taking people's money and not really doing much for it. And the community seems to be okay with it, if I'm reading the situation correctly.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they get a free pass because they came out with Half-Life
and Half-Life 2.
And because they're Valve and Steam, and they provided Steam, and Steam's a great service. Even though Steam is, you know,
They take a 30% cut, don't they?
They take a huge cut. I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but it's not small. And they are still almost a monopoly at this point. So, I mean, take that for what it's worth. But, you know, like any good gigantic corporation, they're always trying to branch out and trying to make more money in different ways.
Diversify.
Diversifying their portfolio, as it were. And, yeah, so there's something else coming down the pipe from Valve. And no, it's, again, not Half-Life 3. No, nothing game-related.
What?
No.
Because they've given up on that.
Yeah, they don't do that anymore. They're not really a game development studio anymore. They are just a money-making organization and trying to get into as many places as possible. So they... CNET... Initially, I don't know if they were supposed to report on it, but they did. And then it was eventually confirmed by Steam, or by Valve, I should say, that there is a thing coming out called Steam.tv, which is their own broadcasting service that they're going to be launching.
Their own streaming competitor to Twitch.
Yes.
I think it initially went live, I believe it was last weekend, and it went live accidentally.
Yes.
And wasn't supposed to, and then ultimately the cat was out of the bag, so Valve had to kind of reluctantly acknowledge it and admit that, yes, it's a thing, and it's still live, it's still running, you can watch current competitions in the International 8 tournament happening on Steam.tv, but it is very much Twitch. If you were to pull up Steam.tv and just look at it, it's Twitch. It is a general live streaming platform with your sidebar of chat and what have you, and yeah.
Yeah, it's Twitch, but unlike Twitch, it has all of the integrations with Steam and with all the social aspect of Steam built in. Chat, all of your friends who are Steam friends already are now already your friends on this thing, and lots of people who are already on Twitch are also already on Steam.
Mm-hmm.
So... this is very interesting, and it's a very bold move being made by Steam here, by Valve here, to launch Steam TV, and I don't know how this is going to go. It has the potential to sink Twitch, and I think this is the first and maybe only thing that does have that potential.
Here's the interesting dynamic to me in this battle that's going to happen between Steam TV and Twitch is you have two very big, very rich companies that can duke it out. Because let's not forget, Twitch is owned by Amazon.
Yes. But here's what I'm thinking. Unlike a YouTube or, you know, Google or anything else, sure, a big company can throw money at a platform.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to have the community support.
True, too.
Twitch currently has the community support as a streaming service. But Steam also already has the community support as this place where people buy and, you know, download and play their games through.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like people are thinking... I know Microsoft also tried to launch their own streaming service as well.
With Mixer, I believe it is.
Yeah, but I don't, like, is it easy to snap in? Is it as easy to use as Twitch in the same context as Twitch?
I believe there's integration through the Xbox One and what have you, but certainly it doesn't have the penetration into the greater consciousness that Twitch does.
Right.
I mean, Twitch is now synonymous with just a streaming platform.
Right. But
like a Netflix type service or,
but Steam is also a synonymous thing in people's heads as well.
It is.
It's almost, it's kind of like if Amazon had just a tab you click on to just start watching stuff. Like if Amazon just was just like, you know what? We're just going to, like they're moving towards a marketplace kind of platform, mm-hmm. as well as a sales thing. What if they just decide, you know what? We have tons of web infrastructure. We're just going to have Amazon videos and it's going to be like YouTube. I mean, it's a weird it might be a little bit weird, but, and it's maybe a little bit too broad because Amazon sells everything. Steam kind of just sells games. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, like, it is kind of like a ubiquitous thing. Now, could the two companies, will they start fighting? Obviously they'll start fighting. It'll be interesting to see how Twitch fights back. Will Twitch start selling games?
That's an interesting question. I mean, if Discord has already started to create a games marketplace, so you have to imagine Twitch wouldn't be far behind. But the interesting thing is Twitch is now an ingrained behavior for people to go and watch and stream things on that platform. It's the, just the obvious top of mind choice for things. So when people change their behavior patterns and then go and watch and stream and use Steam instead, even though they're so, they're just conditioned, if you will, it's just their normal course of behavior to use Twitch for whatever their streaming needs are.
Yeah, that is true. And I guess
Twitch, that's the current, I think, Steam TV would be fighting against.
Yeah, and the other thing I guess Steam would be fighting against is also people who don't necessarily stream, you know, either PC games or current generation games as well. I mean, there is a large number of people who stream like D&D campaigns or, you know, Magic the Gathering tournaments and whatnot on Twitch. And that's sort of already there, and there'd be no reason for people who are just interested in that to go over to Steam for, mm-hmm. if they're just interested in watching Magic tournaments or, you know, other board gaming or what have you, or even classic games. You know, one of like the other well-established things is that's where often speedrunners just have established followings and stuff on Steam as well for classic games, old games from old systems. They're either running on an emulator or they have some elaborate setup of, you know, wires and tubes and gears and chains and whatever else to hook up, you know, using arcane magic to hook up their, you know, old Ataris and Nintendos and whatever else to be streamed on the internet. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. So it.
And Twitch has a diversified content.
Line. Yeah.
And user generated, people using it as a platform to stream whatever, not just, as you said, it could be any of what's on there, D&D campaigns, Magic Gathering campaigns, things like that. But also, just other things. I know a number of wrestling companies are using Twitch as a platform to stream some of their live events now. I know, Tommy Dreamer's House of Hardcore has a weekly thing where they will stream live events or shows on their Twitch page as well. Impact Wrestling recently did a show with, I think Lucha Underground earlier this year, where it was a combined live event that was streamed on Twitch as well. So the content is not always just game related. And we've seen that and spoken about that a number of times when Twitch has gotten into doing some of those mega marathons, with shows, from PBS, like The Joy of Cooking, the Bob Ross painting show, The Joy of Painting.
Yep.
And also it was earlier this year, the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
They've done Doctor Who as well. I'm still waiting for them to do This Old House. But perhaps there may be some challenges with that, you know, by showing old building codes or anything like that. Old, outdated building codes.
Yeah, exactly.
In the state of Massachusetts.
Yeah, so, exactly. But one of the other things that Twitch has going for it is, you know, the marathon sessions that people sometimes do. I mean, there are the weird ones as well, like Twitch plays Pokemon and stuff, which was sort of like a big phenomenon, which still goes on from time to time. Mm-hmm. But also just people generally just playing through, you know, more people who have become more notable in the community for whatever thing, like you might get notable Zelda streamers just kind of doing some crazy thing where they'll just like, this month I'm going to play through every single Zelda game or whatever else, that kind of thing. And, starting next week, actually, coincidentally, and now we're talking about Twitch and stuff, there is actually a month-long Pokemon marathon starting.
Well, it's more than a month long. It's a 10-month
months long, I should say.
Yes, 10 months long. And it's not just people playing Pokemon. It's one of their mega marathons of old shows.
Oh, yes, that's what I... Yes.
Yes.
I misunderstood. I only read the synopsis, the brief Cole's Notes version of this. My mistake. Yes, diversified content. Remember the Pokemon TV series with Ash Ketchum? Actually, it's probably still going. I don't know why I'm saying it.
And it's still Ash.
Yeah, so... Sorry, anyone who's the same age as us, remember when that first started back in the mid-90s?
When Pokemania was a thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
20 years ago?
And then, like, oh, the game's out, and then you get home from school and you can watch the Pokemon TV show?
Yeah.
What? So that's the thing. The cartoon has never gone off the air in 22 years.
Yeah, so it's been constantly going. But over the next several months, Twitch has the rights to be streaming the first 932 episodes of the original Pokemon anime series, as well as every single movie.
And you might remember in Pokemon, during the height of Pokemania, there was Pokemon the movie coming to theaters, and then...
I saw it in the theaters.
So you remember this quite well.
I distinctly actually remember going to see that movie in the theater, and then it came out at the same time as Sleepy Hollow, and I remember, you know, some of the jocks that, you know, used to kind of be jerks or whatever in high school, you know, saw me at the theater. They're like, oh, cool, you going to see Sleepy Hollow? I'm like, oh, yeah, of course I am. It's like, you know, I'm grade 9 or whatever. I'm, like, not going to tell them I'm going to see the Pokemon movie. No, I'm going to see, this cool-looking, maybe horror movie. Yeah, I'm going to see that.
Yeah, blood and gore and maybe some boobs, sure.
Yeah, of course. I'm really going to see Mewtwo.
Wasn't the appeal of that first Pokemon movie there'd be like a new Pokemon?
Yeah.
Like revealed or something?
I think it was the reveal of Mew.
Okay.
And Mewtwo spoke. And it was like mind-blowing because he could speak in full sentences using real English and stuff. Unlike every other Pokemon that only said its own name.
I understand. Yeah,
I remember. You know, I was 14 once.
You were there, man. You were there. But there was Pokemon 2, Pokemon 2000.
I mean, I stopped after the movie. Let's just be clear. I fell off a little bit after, like, the second series started. I was like, eh.
Because it became very...
It's the same thing.
Yeah. It's the same thing. Oh, Ash got a new Pokemon.
Oh, Ash is in a different place now. He's moved out of the Kanto region and he's into wherever else it is, the islands or whatever. Like, I don't know.
But yes, it's kind of followed the same formula through the years. Kind of like, say, how the Power Rangers.
Exactly. I was going to say like Power Rangers.
Has done where there's a formula, you know what it is, and it stays the same, but just different generations move through it. And have it being a part of their youth at various points. So the series, the Mega Marathon starts on Monday, August 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And it's going to last for 10 months, which will take us all the way to, I believe, June 23rd of 2019. So sweet God above, that's a lot of Pokemon.
Yep.
And how it is, it's not a 24/7 marathon. How it's going to work is that from Monday to Thursday, there's going to be 8 hours of new, Pokemon episodes airing. And then Friday and Saturday are going to be used for reruns. And then movies are going to be airing Sundays at 1 p.m. Now, the interesting thing about this is you're not just watching it. You can become, interactive with this as well because the Mega Marathon streaming on Twitch will let users collect Pokemon just as if they were filling out a Pokedex by clicking on a small icon when it appears on the screen right next to the version of the Pokemon creature in the show. So the example I saw in the GIF on the official blog post was of Caterpie. You know, when you see Caterpie on the screen, there's a little icon of Caterpie that appears on your Twitch window and you click that and like, it's added to your Pokedex. Which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean like, might as well use these platforms for all their interactivity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, rather than just, that's the other cool thing about these platforms. I mean, there will be people that'll just want to, you know, jump in and maybe watch it in the background. I mean, the Bob Ross marathon is great for that. I mean, Bob Ross is great to just kind of have on in the background. He's got such a soothing voice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, same thing for Pokemon. Like, you might just be doing something else, just kind of half paying attention. Like, oh yeah, I remember that. It's like when he did whatever. I don't know. There's Team Rocket being Team Rocket again.
Oh, this is the episode where Team Rocket maybe weren't the bad guys the whole time. They helped out Ash.
Yeah.
Because there was another bigger evil that they didn't quite agree with, so.
Yeah. But that kind of thing. But like, you know, if you do want to use the platform to its full potential, the opportunity's there as well. So it's really cool.
So each of the Pokemon you collect by clicking on their icons on the screen is going to give you a certain amount of points, with more points earned for the more rare Pokemon. And these points will feed into an overall leaderboard, though what that all does and what it leads to, we don't know, because this thing isn't done for another 10 months. So there's a lot to go through. If you miss a Pokemon during a certain episode, don't worry, I'm sure it will come up again in a later episode. I don't think there was only ever like one and dones of this one appearance of a Pokemon in one series or one specific episode, because that would be a very jerk thing to do. And also a gross misuse of all the Pokemon.
Though it's possible that they might have had some Pokemon that were only showed once, or maybe if they weren't showed once, they were maybe showed just in the background once or something. I don't know.
Well, like I recall in the original series it being on, basically, or at least my recollection is that each different Pokemon would kind of be a focal point of a different episode. There was one focused on Farfetch'd, the duck Pokemon with the reed in his hand.
Yeah, there was also
Psyduck and Cubone, and it seemed like, and that may have just been because it was a new series and developing a new audience, so you're introducing them to everything as well.
Yeah, but it literally, I mean, look at how many Pokemon there are now.
Oh dear God.
It must have got to a point where it's just like, we're literally introducing three a week. This whole show is just introducing Pokemon now.
There's no coherent story. It's just this one appears and this one appears.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, man, there's a lot of Pokemon series.
It's never stopped.
I mean, yeah, there's like
22 years.
I think I literally only remember Indigo League, which culminated in Pokemon the first movie. And then after the first movie, then Adventures on the Orange Island started. And I'm just going to assume that every single Pokemon series kind of culminated in some movie, so a lot of these I don't know, but yeah, there's what, like, it looks like there's like about 18 or 19 different series, like Indigo League, Adventures on the Orange Islands, the Johto Journeys, Johto League Champions, Master Quest, Advance, so on and so forth, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
There's tons of them. Yeah. Same thing, movies.
Bringing to more current time, where there's the Pokemon XY, XYZ series, which I think also is including the Alola region versions of Pokemon as well, because like the Hawaiian Island style of Pokemon, or like the old Pokemon where they look a bit different. I'm thinking of the example of Raichu, who can surf on his own tail for some reason.
Yeah.
Which makes no sense because he's a goddamn electric mouse.
Yes, he's an electric mouse.
Why is he surfing? Why is he near water? He's going to kill everything.
Yeah, he's going to destroy everything in the water. Everyone's going to get electrocuted. Everyone dead.
Mass casualty event off the coast of Alola today.
Yes. But
and then the movies as well. They air Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern. And there's 15 movies. Like, after a certain point, they just became, like, direct-to-home releases. Oh,
yeah.
But
yeah. Like, very much like The Land Before Time or something, where, like, there was, like, millions of those. Of which I only really remember the first couple of them anyways. But yeah, so.
I think there might be more Pokemon movies than, no, wait, no, Land Before Time is in the 20s.
Yeah, Land Before Time made it like 23 or 4 movies or something.
God.
But, yeah, Pokemon, hell of a thing.
Hell of a thing, and that's why there's 932 episodes that Twitch is going through.
See? Yeah, 932 episodes and 15 movies. That might not even be the complete list either. Like, there might be a couple of things that they're missing,
there might be more recent episodes or more recent series they may not have access to, because even the XY and XYZ games are a couple years old at this point.
Yeah.
So, there's probably, like, at least two or three series I'm guessing that they don't have.
Yeah, you're probably right.
So, sweet God, it could be 1,000 episodes of Pokemon total. God yeah. almighty. All right, well, we're not just going to sit here and reminisce about Pokemon for the rest of the time, but wow. Okay, that's a lot. But again, starts Monday, August 27th at 1 p.m. on Twitch Presents. which you can find a direct link to on our website,
thearcadeshow.com.
I mean, we could easily sit here and reminisce about Pokemon. We won't, because it's not a blast from the past. But, you know, since we're kind of on that topic of things from days gone by, let's get into the blast from the past and talk about what we actually do have in that segment this week.
Yeah.
Two items, a movie, and a TV show.
And there's no point in saying which one's older or younger, because they both debuted around the same time 20 years ago, back in 1998. One is 2 days older than the other. The movie came out 2 days before the TV show debuted.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it makes sense to talk about the movie first, because even though it came out first, in a way it almost feels like the newer thing, which we'll get to in a second. But 1998, August 21st, is when we saw the first, I think, I would say, arguably legitimate comic book movie.
I think that's safe to say.
It wasn't treated like some silly, like, over-the-top, ludicrous, you know, Street Fighter or Judge Dredd or anything like that.
Or
it
was Double Dragon.
Double Dragon.
There was a Double Dragon movie.
Yeah, I mean, video games, whatever, but still comic books. I mean, Howard the Duck came out in the 80s. It's an insane movie. And yes, it is based on a comic book, but it was an insane movie, and people didn't think it was a good movie necessarily.
There was even a very low budget attempt at a Captain America movie in the 80s.
Yeah.
Where he's riding a motorcycle and has the shield on the front, and sure, and he looks terrible in the outfit.
Yeah.
But when people think of the modern Marvel era of comic book movies, it was the first couple Marvel movies that kind of kicked off the acceptance of comic book movies.
Yeah, there was this one and the sequel to this one, followed by the Spider-Man movies and the first couple of X-Men that had people go, oh, I guess these can be good movies.
Well, it's interesting you point that out, because I was actually going to say the first things that would come to mind would maybe be the first Spider-Man and first X-Men movies. But those came after this, because
yeah.
August 21st, 1998 was the debut of Blade, the first Blade movie that maybe was the best choice to try or the best idea to try and make into a modern and mainstream comic book movie, because Blade wasn't really a well-known character compared to the X-Men or Spider-Man or Superman or Batman.
Well, yeah, like, that's exactly it. Like, yeah, of course we've seen Superman movies. Of course we've seen Batman movies. But in a way, they're almost too big of cultural touchstones to be considered comic book characters in a certain way, because they've kind of taken on a life of their own that's much bigger than the, you know, the comic book thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, you know, other things, like other comic book, you know, franchises and characters and stuff we've seen tried to be adapted were normally just kind of treated like over the top ridiculous things. But Blade, yeah, like Blade, dark source material, not really a lot of, I actually didn't even know it was a comic book movie until I looked into it, you know, and that's like the thing, like where like a lot of, like its success came from the fact that people had no preconceived notions about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people, critics and whatever included, probably had no idea as well. They were just thinking, oh, this is a dark, brooding vampire killer who's like a half vampire. Because vampires were kind of cool for a minute there in the late 90s as well.
Mm-hmm.
With Buffy the Vampire Slayer and whatnot.
True enough.
But this like took it like way darker.
Way darker, and also had, you know, decent action elements to it as well. It wasn't just some thin, waifish hero who's trying to kill Dracula at the moment. No, Blade's a badass.
No, yeah, it was Wesley Snipes in, you know, the height of his Wesley Snipes-ness, being, like, top of his game. Wesley Snipes was a badass back in the 90s.
It's true, and for reasons beyond just not paying the IRS, he was genuinely, like, an action martial arts badass, and this is really one of those films. When we think in comic book movies of perfect casting, there's Kelsey Grammer as Beast, there's Patrick Stewart as Professor X, obviously. I think this is one of those perfect castings that maybe doesn't get as much mention as it should.
Yeah, because I mean, but again, it's like a thing where like, a lot of people know about the X-Men. A lot of, like, that's like the thing. Like, I mean, I grew up watching the X-Men cartoon. A lot of people grew up reading X-Men comics, whatever else. Like, we all kind of have it in our heads. Sort of like, even if you never saw the X-Men cartoon, you can kind of tell that Beast would speak probably very erudite and have like a commanding kind of voice, kind of like Kelsey Grammer. Mm-hmm. You'd imagine that, you know, Professor Xavier would have a kind of like a dignity about him, very much like Patrick Stewart brought to the table. But yeah, like Blade, like, was just kind of like, when you think about who else could play him at the time, like, there was no Michael Jai White.
No.
So.
There wasn't. I don't know who else there would have been to play such a prominent role. And it helps that, again, the character wasn't a top A-list Marvel character, because this is now, with this movie, was an opportunity to define it for the first time.
Yeah.
And where no one had really seen the character before to any, in, on any grand stage, and here we are. And it helps that it was actually a really good movie.
Yeah, and I feel that, like, critics, at least up until before Blade came out, would often get it in their heads when something was a comic book movie that they would go into it wanting to hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would write reviews saying, oh, it was so bad and hackneyed and this and that. I mean, granted, they usually were, but they would have a preconceived notion and maybe help kind of mold the public's opinion as well a bit going into it. It's like, oh, this is a terrible comic book movie. It's comic books, you know, kid stuff. Whereas, like, because Blade was like a way lesser known thing, they probably didn't have it in their head that it was a comic book movie. They just probably thought it was just a vampire movie.
And how it was presented too was, it felt and came across as a horror movie.
Yeah, and it
wasn't bright, it wasn't colorful, it wasn't over the top, it wasn't cartoony or outlandish. Like, it wasn't like a Joel Schumacher Batman movie, which was a thing. Those things happened in the 90s, but this was a lot more subdued, and if you had no idea that it was based on a Marvel Comics character, you would just think it's a horror movie with vampires.
Yeah, and I think that really did help it, like you said, where people just kind of accepted it, were more ready to accept it as its own thing, because they didn't have any sort of preconceived thing in their head about what the type of movie it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, comic book movies up to that point were literally just like things like Superman and Batman and,
you know, Superman in the 70s, Batman in the 80s, and for the most part, that was it.
Yeah.
That I can immediately think of, and then...
And then ruined, Batman ruined in the 90s by Joel Schumacher.
Yes.
So that was very much in people's heads, I think, freshly at that point. And so I remember when it was being advertised, and I don't remember them mentioning anything about a comic book or Marvel or anything.
And if you think of the contrast now, 20 years later, it's going to be all Marvel, mentions this character, how it ties into the larger universe, blah, blah, blah. But no, it was Blade, and it had to stand on its own because it didn't have the name recognition of a Spider-Man or X-Men. It didn't have the, really opportunity to sell itself as a comic book movie, because it would have faced a backlash and been sloughed off, if you will, too. And it proved to be very successful, spawning a trilogy. Two more films followed, and still all with Wesley Snipes playing Blade in all of them. And hell, even spawned a very short-lived TV series. Back in the early to mid-2000s, in the early days of Spike TV, Spike TV was marketing itself as the first network for men.
Yeah.
And it was shamelessly going for a male audience demographic.
Yeah, and males of any age, really.
And so they tried to do that, shows like MXC, which we spoke earlier this year of, Most Extreme Elimination Challenge, still funny. And they had The Ultimate Fighter, I think the first couple of seasons of The Ultimate Fighter. And I distinctly recall watching one of the UFC, this was before the UFC blew up to the huge entertainment property it is now. But the UFC was just doing a live fight card on Spike TV. and they were given a promo they had to read to plug the upcoming debut of the Blade TV series, because the trilogy was so popular, make it a TV show, cool. And one of the taglines was, in this promo read on the First Network for Men, was the fact that the Blade TV series would include scenes of a vampire lesbianism.
Spike, they were nothing if consistent with what they were doing.
Shameless about it, too.
Absolutely shameless, yeah. Just as a brief aside, for anyone that doesn't remember Spike TV, it's probably good that you don't remember it, but for those of us that do, do you remember those stupid Star Trek The Next Generation ads where they tried to, like, sexualize the Klingons?
Vaguely.
Like, my God. Anyways, that's all I'll say on that. Just YouTube it. I'm sure it's on YouTube. That's all I'll say about that. But yeah, Blade.
Yeah.
Kudos to Blade for legitimizing comic book movies.
And kind of weird that here we are 20 years on since the debut of Blade and really haven't seen any more Blade movies. Like, it's not a TV thing on Netflix. It's not... He hasn't popped up in the cinematic universe.
Yeah, I think, you know, about 3 or 4 years ago, from what I understand, Wesley Snipes gave an interview at one point saying that he would love to return to the franchise because he feels that there's still, you know, work that's left undone there. And, I don't know, who knows, you know, with Marvel kind of branching out into smaller TV series, maybe a legitimate Blade series could work now and they could make it an 18 plus series, very much like Daredevil, very much like Punisher,
Jessica Jones,
Luke Cage, all of the things. Like it would work at that scale too, I think.
It certainly would. I could see that working.
Plus with the fact that actors now who have been in movies are more ready to go back to TV series at this point now, because TV again, and a lot's happened in the last 20 years. TV is seen as a pretty legitimate, you know, form of, you know, being an actor again, which is cool because of procedurals and, you know, long form TV series that tell a big long story over the course of several seasons.
And production quality and production values on TV series have remarkably increased.
Oh yeah. Like with Game of Thrones and whatnot, really helping to push those boundaries.
Oh, certainly. That it just doesn't look like a cheap syndicated thing like maybe Xena and Hercules did in the mid-90s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're on location at New Zealand, but...
It's the same forest shot again, eh?
Yeah, you only have 7 actors in the whole series right now. What's going on?
Oh, you're in this village again. Oh, just shot it from a different angle.
Oh, and there's Ted Raimi for the 5th time in this episode wearing a different set of facial hair. Okay. But
we're not going to go on and talk about Hercules and Xena as 90s TV shows.
Those are not blasts of the past. That's not the TV series we're talking about. No. There's another TV series that debuted a couple of days after Blade came out on the 23rd of August 1998.
In the year of our Lord.
Yes. Though... The reason why I said earlier was that it felt like it came out earlier was because the setting of it was earlier. It was approximately 20, 25, almost 30 years earlier than 1998 because it was That 70s Show.
Yes, we have reached the point where That 70s Show is now 20 years old.
Yes.
So the 70s were 40 years ago. My, how time keeps marching in a linear fashion. Always indeed. Forward. But That 70s Show, huge hit back in the like late 90s, early 2000s. Comedy, focused on like, again, the group of teens in growing up in Wisconsin in the 70s. And that maybe isn't always a recipe or a formula for a show that would work, but this somehow did. And I'm going to say part of the reason is maybe because that it wasn't all just jokes based around the show winking at the audience being like, huh, the 70s, right?
Yeah, that's a good point because, I mean, I think the way it was initially sold and like how they were kind of like showing trailers and stuff at the time was that that's very much what it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a lot of people checked it out just out of sheer morbid curiosity. And what it ended up turning out was that they just kind of used the backdrop of the 70s just sort of as kind of like there were limits on what the universe was. So like there was no cell phones. There was no anything like that. There was no computer technology. It was just made that part of it a little bit simpler. And it relied on the cast because it was a great ensemble cast.
It was. It was actually a pretty big ensemble cast, but to show that there's this large group of teenage friends and they each very much had their own place in the group.
Yeah. And there were parents that the teenagers all had.
Which they further expanded the cast too.
Yes. And then they all got jobs at different places. And then the jobs at the different places included bosses and stuff and different characters as well.
It fleshed out its own world.
Yeah. So, I mean, while it did take place in the 70s, it never relied on that as a crutch. Like, it kind of, you know, it used it maybe as a quaint backdrop from time to time. But, you know, the problems and, you know, the character developments and everything that happened could have happened at any time, I think.
Mm-hmm. True, and a lot of it was just the interpersonal dynamics of the group, or the parents, or the bosses, and I'd say that the only wink and nod the show made to, 70s, was the inclusion of Tommy Chong.
Yeah, but, I mean, come on. Tommy Chong is great.
As the stoner, like, boss of, not Kelso,
Hyde.
Of Hyde, thank you. But yes, the absolute stoner boss.
Yeah, the hippie stoner boss.
Imagine that. Tommy Chong playing a hippie stoner boss.
Yeah, and then Kurtwood Smith and Don Stark is like, you know, the two sides of the typical 70s dads, I'd say, where Kurtwood Smith was the, you know, the war veteran, you know, the hard ass, you know, always kind of...
Was in Korea.
Was in the Korean War and very much... is always on everyone's ass about everything to the point where he's always making ridiculous jokes about kicking people in the ass or various puns related to that, with one of my favorite Red Foreman lines being, my foot wrote a book. It's called On the Road to In Your Ass, which is just a great line. I laugh every time I think about it. But then, you know, Don Stark playing, the father of, of Donna, who he is more like the leisure suit wearing, like, hey, I'm a salesman. I work at this place. I got the permed hair. I've got the, you know, all the jewelry and stuff, mm-hmm. and the two sides of the 70s dad, like more permissive and cool and fun and whatever else.
It was clearly a hippie in the 60s.
Yeah.
Just kind of moved on into the 70s.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, like a lot of, you know, the careers of a lot of people both launched and stopped at that series. I mean, it did go on for 8 seasons, which you'd think, wow, how did they squeeze so much out of such a limited concept? But again, all the different stories they could tell, mm-hmm. with the cast of characters. And, yeah, it's where we saw the beginnings of the career of Mila Kunis and Ashton Kutcher and Laura Prepon and other characters, you know, other actors in there, you know, were Topher Grace and Danny Masterson and Vilmer Valderrama, which we don't really hear a lot about anymore.
No, I think Danny Masterson is on that rant show on Netflix with Ashton Kutcher.
With Ashton Kutcher, but I mean, really, it's... The only reason why that show's on is because of Ashton Kutcher, who became a superstar.
It's true.
And, you know, Mila Kunis, big movie star now as well, weirdly enough, ended up with him romantically, which we're not a gossip show or anything like that, but whatever.
They're just, married in with kids.
Yeah, they're married with kids, and it was not a thing. I don't know. There's another podcast I think both of us on this program listened to called WTF with Mark Maron, which she was on. She talked about it. It's an interesting listen, But yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about the setting of it was that it kind of because it set itself in the past at the time, forever forward, it's kind of gonna be that, like, it's never gonna be dated because it started out dated. So it's gonna be what it is forever. So
it will have a certain resistance to time.
Yeah. So I feel like it still holds up. I watched a bunch of it a couple years ago and it's some funny episodes, some funny stuff still. I don't know if it holds up for all 8 seasons.
Probably not, because again, it was doing 8 seasons of like 20 to 23 episodes per. You don't really see that with comedies now.
No, and there's a reason for that, because I mean, everything kind of runs its course.
And even on That 70s Show, I think the last 2 years, Topher Grace had left. I think Laura Prepon had left. So like some of the main characters had left. And then you saw Kurtwood Smith as Red Foreman take on a more prominent role.
Yeah, which is fine. He's a great character. I love Kurtwood Smith. He's a fantastic actor. But still, like, there's only so much you can really do with literally the years 1976 to 1979. Because 8 seasons is supposed to take place over the course of those 3 years.
You can only have them in school for so many episodes.
Yeah.
At some point, they should goddamn graduate.
Exactly. And then I do remember, actually, after That 70s Show ended, they did briefly try to have That 80s Show, and it didn't work at all. It was just...
I think that's the one where they actually tried to make the joke and nature of comedy the 80s, right?
Yeah, like everything was literally like, look at my cell phone! It was just literally that big, crazy gray brick. And then like, oh, I'm going to go to the dance club. It's like things like that.
And someone no doubt had like a Flock of Seagulls haircut.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And I feel like that got canceled after less than one season.
Oh, I think it was a couple episodes.
Yeah.
If it was lucky. I do remember, like you, the trailers on TV for that and it looking like hot garbage. Sweet hot garbage.
Yeah. I actually remember watching the first episode, and I didn't watch the whole episode.
It's a strong indictment of That 80s Show. But again, it only existed because That 70s Show was enough of a hit that executives at Fox were like, hey, how can we spin this off? How can we capitalize on the success? And so thus That 80s Show was born and died. Should have never left the womb.
Exactly. But that 70s Show, however.
20 years old. August 23rd, 1998. Good God, it's 20 years old. But still mostly holds up. And before that, we spoke of Blade, the vampire character, who actually, the character of Blade started in 1973. So a neat little interesting tie-in and connection there.
Yes.
So That 70s Show... The kids may have been reading Blade comics on the series.
Yeah, they may have been.
And then Blade the movie, August 21st, 1998, the first major modern mainstream Marvel movie.
Some good alliteration you got going there.
Thank you. I practiced that before I came here. So those are your blasts from the past for this week. And I'd have to say now that we've done that, we should probably say our goodnights and skedaddle on out of here because we're out of other things to talk about. And really, we'd just be dragging things on awkwardly and it'd be painful after a while. So we don't want to do that to you.
No.
We'll spare you. But we do have one point of business to mention before we get on out. We will be away next week. For next week, we'll be leading into the Labor Day weekend because we're at Labor Day.
We sure are.
Sweet God above. But hey, we'll be taking a week off to enjoy the last little throes of summer before it gets into the fall season when we have to wear jackets and hoodies the whole time. Or not, maybe it's just an abnormally warm fall.
Yeah, maybe, you know, once the nukes hit, we'll be, I'm just assuming that that's going to happen at some point.
Oh my God, Christmas at Ground Zero will be even more relevant of a song.
Yes.
But hopefully the nukes don't fly. And if they do not fly, we shall return with a new episode for you on Friday, September 7th. So we hope you enjoy your long weekend. Let us know your plans, what you're going to be gaming on your system of choice. You can email us, info@thearcadeshow.com.
I know for me, it's going to be Octopath Traveler still.
Very nice. You're still working your way through.
Oh yeah.
How much time do you have into it?
I think about 14, 15 hours.
And that translates into like how far of completion into the game, or is there?
I don't know what percent it is, but I know I've just about finished the first chapter for all of the 8 characters, so I'm just about to move on to the second chapter for the first character.
Very nice. Well, good luck with that. If you are playing Octopath Traveler and can inform Dennis of just how far he is in the overall scope of the game, you can also let us know on social media, on our various channels. We are on Twitter at The Arcade Show. You can direct message us and follow us through there. And on Facebook, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. Like our page, give us a follow there as well. Let us know your comments through that medium. Or if you want to be awkward about it, in the reviews of our program on the podcast section of both iTunes and Google Play, we have direct links to both of our pages on those platforms on our homepage, TheArcadeShow.com. So until 2 weeks hence, we'll join you again on Friday, September 7th. Until then, good night, everybody.
Good night.